Verse 6, Christ said to his apostles, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. If you had known me, you should have known my Father also. And from henceforth you know him and have seen him. Now Christ said to his apostles in very, very plain terms at this point that if they had known him, they had known the Father. Now I just wonder at what depth of disappointment Christ must have experienced when they said to him in verse 8, Philip said unto him, Lord, show us the Father, and it sufficeth us. In other words, these apostles had been completely unable to realize that Jesus and the Father were one. They had a picture of God in the Old Testament that was different from the Christ whom they knew in their daily walk together with him. And so in verse 9 Jesus says, Have I been so long time with you, and yet hast thou not known me, Philip? He that has seen me hath seen the Father. And how sayest thou then, Show us the Father? In the last study we made the point that the average person today looks upon the God of the Old Testament as being a very different person from Jesus Christ in the New. But Jesus said very plainly at this point that if they had known Jesus Christ, if they'd seen Jesus Christ, then whom had they seen? The Father. Because the two are perfectly and completely identical. This argument is strengthened by Christ's words in John the 5th chapter. And this is one of the most wonderful verses, I think, so far as this point is concerned. John chapter 5, verse 19 and 20. Then answered Jesus and said unto them, Verily, verily I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he seeth the Father do. For what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. For the Father loveth the Son, and showeth him all things that himself doeth, and he will show him greater works than these, that you may marvel. Now let's just take the facts that the statement presents to us. First of all, Jesus said the Son can do nothing of himself. God was the fountain, the source of all that Jesus Christ did. But what did Jesus do? He did what the Father did. I mean, he did what he saw the Father do. The question then arises, did God provide Jesus Christ with a limited revelation of what he himself did? Or did Jesus Christ see all things that the Father did? All things. And the answer is given to us there in verse 20 where it says, And the Father loveth the Son and showeth him how much? All things that himself doeth. So then, let's put these facts together. In the first case, God had given to Christ a complete revelation of those things which he himself did. What Christ saw the Father do, he did. Not most of the things the Father did, but all the things the Father did. And what is more, Jesus Christ did them likewise. And what does this word likewise mean? In the same way. As the Father did them, so in turn the Son did them. This means that if you want to know what God does, then where do you look? You look at Jesus Christ. And anything that we tend to feel that God does, but which we cannot find Christ doing, then we are to know that God does not do those things. Now in the past, and so far as the average person is concerned in the world today, there's a very, very firm conviction that God destroys, God takes life, that God brings to an end the life which is given to different individuals because of their sinful course of action. This then is an idea, a concept, a belief. And that concept and that belief is under challenge by the words of this verse. Because if it is believed that God destroyed, that God took life, then we must be able to find Jesus Christ doing the same thing. But can we do that? That's impossible. Throughout the entire lifetime of Jesus Christ, he never took the life of a single person. Not once. Yet, Christ did only what the Father did. Christ did all things that the Father did exactly as the Father did them. What conclusion then must we draw from these facts? That if Christ did all the Father did exactly as the Father did it, but never destroyed a single person, then what about God? Same thing, exactly. Now, there came a time when Jesus Christ was specifically invited to destroy some people. You find the story back in the book of Luke. Let's turn back there. Luke the 9th chapter. And the story surrounds the last journey which Christ was making from the north back to Jerusalem before he was crucified. And as he traveled, he had to pass down to the land of Samaria. And as he passed down to this land, he asked two of his disciples to go into a village and arrange for an evening of accommodation, and no doubt for the conducting of a sermon, a study or something like that. In Luke 9 verse 51, we find the opening of this little story. And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elias did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you know not what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. When James and John saw the attitude and the spirit of these Samaritans, saw their pride, their self-sufficiency, and their rejection of Jesus as a messenger amongst them, they were very, very annoyed. They were indignant. And they felt that this should be signally punished. Now these men, no doubt at that time, in fact quite certainly at that time, had the prevailing concept of the God of the Old Testament. They saw him as one who dealt quite swiftly to deal with those who did not obey him. And we can know this for certain because of the concept they had of the kingdom which Christ had come to establish. They believed that Christ would come in due time with a sword. They saw Christ attempting first of all to win the support of the Jews by argument, by love, by kindness. But there would come a time, they believed, when this ministry would end and then Christ would take the sword and would destroy all those who refused to come into harmony with his kingdom. Now that belief is one that's consistent with the average concept both then and today. And when these men invited Jesus Christ to bring down fire from heaven, they were inviting him to do what they thought that God would do in a similar situation. And in the book Desire of Ages, Sister White remarks upon the response of Christ to them. Page 487. I read the words here. Coming to Christ, they reported to him the words of the people, telling him that they had even refused to give him a night's lodging. They thought that a grievous wrong had been done him, and seeing Mount Carmel in the distance where Elijah had slain the false prophets, they said, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them even as Elias did? They were surprised to see that Jesus was pained by their words, and still more surprised as his rebuke fell upon their ears. You know not what spirit you're of, what manner of spirit you're of. The Son of Man has not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them, and he went to another village. When these men came to Christ and said, Lord, shall we call down fire from heaven and destroy these rejecters of your mercy? Christ said to them, you don't know what manner of spirit you're of. Now when Christ said that, he was denying that the spirit which activated them was his spirit. That the spirit in him would not lead him to take this attitude or to make this kind of response to what those Samaritans had done toward him or toward his message. And therefore, if that was not his spirit, in like manner it was not his Father's spirit, because both spirits are the same. Further, he said, he had not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. As I read those words, I think to myself what Christ might have said. First of all, Christ spoke the truth. His statement is quite flat, quite complete. He says, I have not come to destroy, I have come to save. Now Christ could have said, I have come, first of all, to save men's lives, and then to destroy those who will not be saved. Christ could have said that. And no doubt would have said that if the general concept of Christ's mission is correct. But he simply said, I have not come to destroy. I haven't. I've come to save. Now if Jesus Christ came to save and not to destroy, then how does God come to us? In the same way, doesn't he? It must be the same way, because the Father and the Son are engaged in the same work. And I hope that I'll be able to show you how that God comes to men only, and let me underline the word only, as a Saviour. God comes to men in no other way but as a Saviour. That every movement, every action, every work of God is to save and never to destroy. And any destruction which comes is in spite of God's efforts and not because of them in any sense of the word whatsoever. And now coming back to the Desire of Ages, Sister White makes further comment upon the words of Jesus Christ, especially dwelling upon this thought of the spirits that activated these men to suggest that they called down fire from heaven to consume those rejecters of Christ's mission. So I read further here in the book Desire of Ages. It is no part of Christ's mission to compel men to receive him. It is Satan and men actuated by his spirit that seek to compel the conscience. Under a pretense of zeal for righteousness, men who are confederate with evil angels bring suffering upon their fellow men in order to convert them to their ideas of religion. But Christ is ever showing mercy, ever seeking to win by the revealing of his love. He can admit no rival in the soul, nor accept the partial service. But he desires only voluntary service, the willing surrender of the heart under the constraint of love. Now this last sentence in the paragraph we're going to look at very, very carefully. But take it just as it reads and notice full significance. There can be no more conclusive evidence that we possess the spirit of Satan than the disposition to hurt and destroy those who do not appreciate our work or act contrary to our ideas. When Sister White says there can be no more conclusive evidence that we possess the spirit of Satan, she is saying that the most conclusive evidence, the most positive evidence, the most certain evidence that anyone possesses the spirit of Satan is that disposition to hurt or destroy those who do not appreciate our work or who act contrary to our ideas. That's the spirit of Satan. God has nothing of the spirit of Satan. Therefore, does God have any disposition to hurt or destroy those who don't appreciate his work or who act contrary to his ideas? Does he? Absolutely not. Because God's spirit is the total opposite from Satan's spirit. The total opposite. It is Satan's spirit, and men actuated by that spirit, that leads them to hurt and destroy those who do not appreciate their work or who act contrary to their ideas. But let's examine the works of God for a moment in the light of this statement. Let's go back to the pouring out of fire upon the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we've asked two very simple questions. Did the people of Sodom and Gomorrah appreciate the work of God? Not at all. Did they act contrary to God's ideas? Yes. Now, let's just phrase this next question carefully. Were they destroyed? I didn't say did God destroy them, I said did their destruction come because they acted contrary to God's ideas? Yes, that is exactly right. But now I must ask the next question. If God destroyed them because they did not appreciate his work or act contrary to God's ideas, then what did God prove to us in this situation? You get the question? If God destroyed them because they did not appreciate his work or acted contrary to his ideas, then what did God prove to us at Sodom and Gomorrah? Right. Then God would have proved to us that he had the spirit of Satan, if the statement is correct, and of course it is correct. Now, isn't that right? Let me say it again. Sister White says here, there can be no more conclusive evidence that we possess the spirit of Satan than the disposition to hurt and destroy those who do not appreciate our work or who act contrary to our ideas. Therefore, if God destroyed the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, who did not appreciate his work and who acted contrary to his ideas, then God gave to us the most conclusive evidence that he has the spirit of Satan. And God does not have the spirit of Satan. In no sense of the word at all can that be true. God does not have the spirit of Satan, but he has the very opposite spirit altogether from that which Satan has. Now, at the moment, we're not going to make any attempt to see what did happen back there at Sodom and Gomorrah. At the moment, we are comparing statements which say that God destroys with these principles, which at the moment is the revelation of the life of Jesus Christ. Revelation of the life of Christ is a revelation which denies that God at any time destroyed, took the lives of any person down in the past. And the argument that we're considering right now is this, that Jesus Christ in the planet of the said that he saw everything the Father did. He did what he saw the Father do exactly as the Father did it. Therefore, if we are to believe that God in the Old Testament destroyed anybody, then we have to find Jesus Christ doing the same thing. But as surely as we cannot find Jesus Christ doing any such thing, then as surely we can know that God likewise never destroyed anybody at any time or at any place. And here in Luke, the 9th chapter, we find a direct invitation being given to Christ to destroy men and women who had flatly and insultingly rejected his work, his ministry, and his message. And when invited to do so, Jesus simply and plainly said that there was not his spirit, there was not his work. He had come to save, he had not come to destroy. Let's go a little further now into the ministry of Jesus Christ, and I want to take up the question of the law. A year or so back, we noticed together that as we come down toward the banks of the Jordan River, toward the promised lands, that the law of God would be repeated, that God would open up to us new heights and depths of understanding so far as the law is concerned. And these new heights and depths of understanding would take us far beyond the old legal framework of a series of thou shalt do and thou shalt not do, but rather brings us down to the great abiding principles of what the law really stands for. And in the last great conflict, the law will be the very center of the issues of this conflict. In the past, we thought that all we had to do was simply prove the seventh day to be the Sabbath. That's what we thought. But today we realize that simply proving the technical point of a seventh-day Sabbath will fall far short of the nature of the conflict to be waged when we come to the last great struggle. The law of God and the character of God are one. In the book Christ's Object Lessons, page 315, right in the heart of the chapter without a wedding garment, I read these words in connection with the law of God. God requires perfection of his children. His law is a transcript of his own character. And it is the standard of all character. This infinite standard is presented to all that there may be no mistake in regard to the kind of people whom God will have to compose his kingdom. The life of Christ on earth was a perfect expression of God's law. And when those who claim to be children of God become Christ-like in character, they will be obedient to God's commandments. Then the Lord can trust them to be of a number who shall compose the family of heaven. Clothed in the glorious apparel of Christ's righteousness, they have a place at the king's feast. They have a right to join the blood-washed throng. Now the important point we want to notice here is this. Sister White plainly declares that the law is a transcript of his own character. Now, in other words, God does righteousness, but he is not merely a doer of righteousness. The Lord is righteousness. Which means that his very character, his very nature, his very being is righteousness through and through and through. Now what is it? What is a transcript? It comes from two Latin derivations, scribo, I write, and trans, across. It means to write across the very thing which already is there. So here we have then the character of God. And over here we have the law of God. This, we're told, the law of God is a transcript of the character of God. In other words, this is a writing over here of that which is over here. And how much difference is there between them? How much difference?
None.
Why not? Because this is not just a transcript, it's a perfect transcript. Isn't that correct? It's a perfect transcript. An accurate transcript. So if we wish to know what the character of God is, then we read the law of God and then we find the answer. Now last night I noticed with you a statement in Revelation 19 verse 11. Let's just turn back there for a moment and look at this once again. Revelation 19 and verse 11. It tells the story of the second coming of Jesus Christ. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. I'm very glad this text does not merely say that he judges and makes war. Where is the emphasis in this verse? In righteousness. How shall I know what righteousness is? There's a very simple answer to this. Righteousness, and let me write this on the board so we can really see it. And I think there'll be no one here who can disagree with this. Righteousness is law-keeping. Isn't that correct?
Right.
Righteousness is law-keeping. So this verse then in Revelation 11, and I find a great deal of value in substituting for the word given something else which says the same thing. So therefore the text is saying, and in law-keeping he doth judge and make war. Would that be correct? In righteousness he doth judge and make war. In law-keeping he doth judge and make war. Now the law says, thou shalt not kill. So how does Christ make war? Right. How does Christ judge? Without killing. The word of God says so because in righteousness he doth judge and make war. Now is it possible for man to make war without killing? No. Therefore, is it possible for man to make war in righteousness? It's impossible. Not in true and complete righteousness. And likewise, man cannot judge without killing. And therefore, he cannot judge in righteousness. And we know, of course, that human judges are unrighteous people indeed. But some people say to us, well, that's all very, very well and good, but what does God mean when God says, thou shalt not kill? And men say to us that there is such a thing as lawful killing and there's unlawful killing. So they have what we shall term a magnification of the law. And man's magnification is that. Now what does man understand to be lawful killing? First of all, in self-defense. Just before I left Australia, there was a case of a man who burst in upon a group of people. I don't know the precise details, it doesn't really matter, because the story goes something like this. And this man came in and began to kill off the people in this house one after the other. I think he killed two or three. And a young woman of about 16 or 18 years of age snatched up a gun and shot the killer dead, thus saving her own life and the life of anybody else who had not yet been killed in this kind of a mass murder. Naturally, of course, she was taken to court and tried. And the judge listened to the story from the witnesses and so forth. And when the time came for him to give the verdict, he said to the girl, "I commend you on your action. You acted bravely. You acted wisely. You did what you ought to have done in this situation. And I set you completely free as a justified person. Your killing of that man was a commendable and justifiable thing." So that judge, consistent with the attitude of man, was calling her act of destroying another human being an act of lawful killing, wasn't he? That's what he was saying. Now a second area in which men describe killing to be lawful, when they say not condemned for doing it, is when the state executes a murderer, a rapist or something like that, where the death decree of course is still in existence. And thirdly, when the enemy comes in across your borders, the state declares it's legal and lawful to go out and kill just as many of the enemies you possibly can, until he is deterred from his invasion and retires defeated to his own shore. Now this is man's magnification of the law of God. And we ask ourselves the question, is that magnification of the law of God accurate and true and valid? To find out, where shall we go? And the answer is given to us here in the book Christ Object Lessons, page 315, once again, where it says, "The life of Christ on earth was a perfect expression of God's law. And when those who claim to be children of God become Christ-like in character, they will be obedient to God's commandments. The life of Jesus Christ was a perfect expression of the law of God." And the word perfect means not only without fault, without defect, it also means complete, total. So that God has not only written down in the law a transcript of his character, but Jesus Christ has come to give to us the magnification of that law. In fact, as you know, back in Isaiah 42, there's a prophecy there in regard to the coming of Jesus Christ and the mission of Jesus Christ, in which it is said he will magnify the law and make it honorable. Isaiah 42 and verse 21. "The Lord is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will magnify the law and make it honorable." What is a magnification? Enlargement. Now very often you may be traveling and in the far distance you see something moving. You can't be sure what it is. But you have a pair of field glasses with you and you focus these upon the moving object. There's a 10 or 20 times magnification and you're very quickly able to see what this is. The larger the enlargements, the greater the ability of the person to see exactly what is there. Questions are answered, doubts are removed, and so forth. Way out there in space, for instance, there are stars, planets, moons, and whatnot. And men have been asking questions for generations and generations as to what was on the moon, for instance. As I got larger and larger magnification of the moon, question after question became answered. Now with the law of God, people may say, "Well now, when God said thou shalt not kill, what did he really mean? Did he mean that there's no situation where it's ever to kill, or are there exceptions to this rule?" To find the answer, We look at the magnification of the law, and that magnification is given to us in the life of Jesus Christ. And what is the message of the life of Jesus Christ? It is simply this. I want now to compare the magnification of the law of God as given by Jesus Christ with the magnification of the law of God as given by mankind. And I wish to make reference now to the school, the school of Satan. Satan, of course, has many schools, but the principal one I want to look at right now is the media, the entertainment media, the films, television programs, novels, and other kinds of stories that Satan is presenting before the world day by day. And I thought to myself, as I consider this point, that Satan certainly is very diligent to continually and incessantly to keep hammering into the minds of people his philosophy and his concept in regard to the law. Now I know that we as the people do not find our entertainment in this field, and that's a good thing. But I'm sure that all of us at some time in the past have had some contact with the kind of story, the kind of philosophy which is presented through this kind of media. Now let's think about it very carefully. We take a typical Western person. Here, shall we say, is a ranch, or maybe a little town. For this story, we'll say a little town. And in this little town, the film portrays a segment of society where the people, generally speaking, live happily, contentedly, and lawfully together. They respect each other. They love each other. No one steals from anybody else. And the film portrays a group of good people. But then there enters upon the scene a bad man. And this bad man usually rides a black horse, has a black hat, black clothing, has a kind of a dark or a swarthy complexion, and has with him a group of desperados. And these bad men begin to subject this village to thieving and lying and possibly even killing. And the village find itself quite helpless in the grip of this powerful man. They can't free themselves, and they pass into a period of bondage under his control. Now, up until this point, Satan has, through this film, portrayed the exact predicament of the human family. Because the human family, generally speaking, the average person is a reasonably good person. They don't commit any big bad crimes. Of course, they have their family quarrels, and they don't have real righteousness, they don't commit big bad crimes. They're good neighbours to one another. You think of the nice people who live down your street, for instance. And so they're relatively law-abiding. But dominant over them is an evil person, the devil, with his supporters and desperados. So Satan has portrayed in the film so far a universal human problem. Now, at this point, there enters the scene in the film a good man, usually on a white horse, with a white hat, nice light clothing, a nice, handsome, open face, a strong man with the ability to make quick decisions and to execute them, a man of courage, a man of determination, a man even of great sacrifice. And as this man looks upon the situation here, he doesn't even consider what this will cost him. He doesn't go out to save these people for money or for fame. He does it because his soul is stirred with indignation at what he sees. He risked his very life to do this, to deliver this village from the hand of the oppressor. And in doing that, Satan is giving to us the picture, a picture of Jesus Christ. And so far, the picture is quite accurate, because Christ comes as the pure and holy one. He came with great courage, he came with great faith, he came to save mankind not for money nor for fame, but because his soul was stirred with indignation by what he saw. Now, at this point, the picture changes. At this point, the parallel ceases. Having carried us along with a truthful picture so far, and having gained, shall we say, the sympathy and interest of the audience in the work of this hero, then Satan now injects into this type of Jesus Christ the picture of God as Satan desires men to see God. The bad man, what does he do? He is a thief. I'll tell them, he's a liar, he is a thief, and he is a murderer. He's all those three things. That's the bad man. Now, to get rid of the bad man, what does the good man do? He also becomes a liar. He also becomes a thief, and he also becomes a murderer. Isn't that true? This you'll find again and again and again and again, repeated in story after story that the devil presents before the minds of men. Now, as people look at the story and they see the bad man, as they call him, lying, stealing, and murdering, then in the eyes of the audience, that bad man is a very, very bad man indeed. But when they see the good man, as they call him, that he lies, stealing, and murdering, then their attitude toward this man is altogether different. In the eyes of the audience, that man's actions are completely justified. And the message of the film, of the story, is this, that this man had to lie, he had to steal, and he had to kill, because otherwise he could never have defeated the lion, the thief, and the murderer who was preying upon this village. So what is Satan saying? Satan is saying this, in order to uphold the law, you've got to do what? Break the law. That's Satan's philosophy. Now, people go to these films and they think they're being entertained, but they're not. Well, they are, but more than that, they're being educated. They're being educated into Satan's philosophies and Satan's lies. Remember that from the very, very beginning, Satan's especial warfare has been against the law of God. Perhaps I should read this statement to you again, contained here in the book Great Controversy. The page is 582. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. To deceive men and thus lead them to transgress God's law is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. Whether this be accomplished by casting aside the law altogether or by rejecting one of its precepts, the result will be ultimately the same. He who offends in one point manifests contempt for the whole law. His influence and example are on the side of transgression, he becomes guilty of all. And note that, Sister White says, he who offends in one point manifests contempt for the whole law. His influence and example are on the side of transgression, he becomes guilty of all. In seeking to cast contempt upon the Bible statutes, Satan has perverted the doctrines of the Bible, and errors have thus become incorporated into the faith of thousands who profess to believe the Scriptures. The last great conflict between truth and error is but the final struggle of a long-standing controversy concerning the law of God, and we might therefore add, concerning the character of God, or the righteousness of God. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah, between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. Now, in the last 30 minutes, we just make a quick point here and pick up the same point that we resume again at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Satan's philosophy then is clearly portrayed in this way, over and over and over again, incessantly, in the various programs of the world. Now, Jesus came down to accomplish the work of delivering the entire world from unrighteousness. Christ came to save mankind from lying, from thievery, and from murdering, and not just from the sin itself, but from the very people who commit those sins. Christ came to save us from sin and from sinners, from both. And in doing that, throughout his entire life upon this earth, did Christ ever once steal anything? Never. Did he ever tell a lie? Never. Did he ever kill? Never. And in the life of Jesus Christ, he has given to us the witness that in righteousness he doth judge and make war. That the only way to defeat law-breaking is by perfect law-keeping. And that makes sense, doesn't it? The only way to defeat law-breaking is by perfect law-keeping. That's the message of the life of Jesus Christ. That's not the philosophy of Satan or those who follow after him. I have to stop. The 45 minutes is up. We'll pick up this thought again when we meet in just a few minutes, that is at 4 o'clock.